Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
Well, this is Dick Staub, your host, and I want to thank you for joining us tonight for our annual Christmas celebration with our very special guest all the way from Phoenix, Arizona. What was your name again?
Russ.
Let's all have a big round of applause for Russ. He's come all the way from Phoenix, Arizona, and he has no idea what this event is. He just was flown immediately, brought by limo to our show, and that happens a lot at the Kindling's Muse. Well, we're at Hales Ales Brewery and Pub, where Jeff Cuse and I are finishing off the last of a brewer's special of the smoked porter.
Yes.
Did anybody have it?
Yes.
You did? It's unbelievable. Did you, Scott?
I did.
Yeah, Scott will be performing later tonight, so we'll all be looking forward to that. So anyway, we're very happy about that. This is our annual Christmas show for the Kindlings, and we've got very special guests with us tonight. Dr. Jeff Cuse from Seattle Pacific University. Big round of applause for Dr. Jeff Cuse. Dr. Chris Chaney joins us from Seattle Pacific University. And let's have a big round of applause for Chris.
Thank you.
And to complete the clean sweep, Jeff Overstreet, no doctor, but he's really good with animals.
Esquire.
Anyway, Jeff Overstreet. And he's, an amazing author and film critic, and he happens to work at Response Magazine at Seattle Pacific. Later on, Dan Voltman will be singing, Scott and Pam Nolte will be performing. These are all Kindling's Hearth alum, and we're glad to have them all with us tonight. And as a very, very special treat tonight, we every year Jenny produces a baby for our Christmas show. And her husband is really excited about this because we're expecting this now every year. The audience kind of shows up to see did she come through.
Yeah.
And this year she did, and we have Carter.
I came through, yeah. Little
Jenny,
Carter.
Tell us about Carter.
Little
tell
Carter
us about
Mon.
your experience as a mother now for the second time.
For the second time. Well,
yeah, Jenny, by the way, is the producer of this show. Let's have a big round of applause for Jenny Spohr.
Yes, I'm not a random woman off the street that produces babies every year. That's not,
yes.
You know.
Well, that's part of what it means to be a producer,
I kind
Jenny.
Of produce, exactly. I produce a little baby, right, each month, right, for the show.
It's not every
show's
month,
my baby.
Each year.
I'm saying the show is my baby a little bit, right? Little baby.
Oh, okay, I get it.
I don't know.
Yeah.
What's funny about Carter is he's kind of got blonde hair and blue eyes, and my husband and I both have dark hair and dark eyes. So I feel like we're very Madonna and Child. Like, he looks like the very Anglo-Western European Jesus.
How
you
nice.
Know, so that's great.
Are you, like, heading into miracle territory here that you're trying to build up to?
Yeah, I'm trying to be sainted at some point in my life, if that can happen. Yeah.
Carter
Not
was
on this
named
show.
After a president.
Yes.
Can anybody guess which president it was named after?
John McCain?
Yeah.
That was a good guess on two fronts.
Thanks.
The next one's going to be
the president.
I teach theology.
The next one's going to be Maverick. So that was
exactly. There you go.
That was just middle.
So how did you choose Carter's name?
Well, Carter, my husband and I both respect Jimmy Carter quite a bit. David, my husband, grew up in Washington, D.C. and was actually there when Jimmy Carter was elected. His daughter went to school right across the street from where my husband grew up. And so he's always had an affinity for Jimmy Carter. And I... we both really appreciate what he's done for the voiceless of this world. He used his fame and his influence to help people in the world instead of sort of have a library and get large quantities of money.
But he does have a library.
He does have a library, yeah. But there's that, you know, he really is helping out, and I feel like spreading the gospel in a way that I really respect, and I hope that my son will walk in those footsteps of spreading the gospel for those who need it and who haven't heard it.
Sweet. So he's already a Democrat? Well, he's already registered.
Yeah, my husband's an independent, so I don't think that would he would you know oh. genetically. I don't think he's a Democrat, but yeah.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Yeah. Good. But in his named after his middle name is after.
So have you guys started any Christmas traditions for little? Where's Sienna?
There she is.
Where's Sienna? Sienna.
Sienna.
There you are, Bob.
There's Sienna. Let's all hear a big round of applause for Sienna. Sienna was on the show a few years ago when she was the baby of the year.
That's right.
Yeah.
And she was making fussy noises too, just like Carter was about to
no,
do.
No, no, Carter's doing great.
Oh, Bob.
There we go.
Yeah, we actually do an advent tree. We get a tabletop tree, and we bring out little nativity set figures every night, like a sheep one night, a Mary, and things. The problem with our advent tree this year is it died within like 2 days. And so it's total Charlie Brown advent tree. Like Mary is falling off the branches. I'm like, the camel is not even going to make it. Like, we just need to take out the tree and have it on the debit. But that's what we like to do to try to... And Sienna knows that we had to tell her that there's no Santa. Shh.
Wait a minute. How old is Sienna?
I know. She's 3, and she was very scared of Santa. Like, so scared that we couldn't even talk about Christmas. So we had to tell her the truth, didn't we, honey? That
what
Santa's
truth?
Just pretend. And that people just dress up. And she says, though, that Christmas is about the baby Jesus anyway. Yeah. So... Ding, I'm doing my job as, you know,
no, not exactly.
Mother, right?
Because Sienna's wearing a birthday shirt today.
Yes.
And when is her birthday?
August.
And I said, Sienna, so you wanted to wear your birthday shirt so you'd be like near baby Jesus' birth? No. She just wants to celebrate her birthday.
Exactly.
So you don't get points yet.
Well.
It's not like the halo is ready to be shined.
That's right.
Yeah, you're pretty
Sainthood
close,
and halos. Yeah, they're,
pretty
you know.
Close. Yeah. Well, Jenny, thank you for being with us tonight.
Yeah.
Yay. Coming all the way. Is this your first public appearance?
Yeah. I guess so. I guess you'd say that.
Yeah. Would you like to talk about the placenta or anything?
Oh, no. Well, I was joking that was the only thing I didn't feel. So that's when the epidural kicked in.
It didn't kick in before, but he felt it.
So,
let me tell you.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Give him the microphone. I want to hear that. I want to get that on tape.
No, I was going to say, you can hear all that crying.
I want to hear the mic on him. Let's hear it for Carter, ladies and gentlemen.
Baby Jesus.
The baby Jesus.
That's, you know. Guys,
thank you,
thanks,
Jenny.
Guys. Good
and
to see
David.
You in January. I'll
we'll
be back.
See you in January. Okay. Jenny will be back to host the show in January. And Carter will be providing the background noises.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you.
We are talking about the end of the world.
Yeah, the end of the world show will be in January. Carter will be hosting it. Well, so meanwhile, back to you guys. Everybody going to be in Seattle for Christmas this year?
Yeah.
Yep.
No
yep.
dramatic plan. Where are you
going to
be?
We're going to Portland to see my family.
Okay.
And
that's the annual thing?
The annual thing, yeah.
Yeah.
And in August, we'll celebrate Christmas with Ann's family down in New Mexico. So I know. It's you know,
August.
It's when we get down there. So.
So you'd like do a tree and stuff? Or?
No. Gifts. Prayers.
Seriously, in August?
No, not really.
Okay.
We'll go see them. We'll acknowledge all the things that are important to us, but
good,
we wish they could be here.
Yeah. And Jeff, you're headed off to the UK next year.
I am in March. Yep. End of March through July. I'll be the visiting research scholar at Blackfriars Hall in Oxford. So it'll be kind of fun.
Wait a minute. Let's savor that moment. Mm. What was that again?
Visiting research scholar at Blackfriars Hall in Oxford.
You want to learn how to pronounce that before
that's
you
right.
actually get
yes. Very important for the Lewis people in the room. Blackfriars is the Dominican college right next door to the Eagle and Child. So it actually through the back entranceway to where the chapel is, you can go right into the back of the pub. So, which is very important.
Yeah. So you're going to be like pretending to be at the school, but
I'm just saying the Dominicans are going to treat me right. So
wow, that's amazing.
So, yeah, it'll be good.
And what will you be doing there?
I'll be working on 2 book projects while I'm over there and teaching a couple of research seminars.
Wow.
So.
Yeah. Are these books that people like me can read? Or?
Yes, they are. I'm doing one book on a philosopher named Paul Ricoeur, but then the more popular book I'm doing a book on Stephen King. So
really,
I am. Yep. It's the title is God's Reluctant Stenographer: The Theology of Stephen King. Nobody's ever done an extended look at all of his writing theologically.
And amazing.
The Stand.
So I got that.
The Stand.
Oh yeah, it's in the very beginning. So. So that's in process right now. So
you got hooked into Stephen King very early?
I did, yep. Horror and Christmas always come together. So.
Did he write any Christmas piece?
He did. He did, actually, in a couple of his novels. Christmas plays a very important, and particularly in The Shining, there's a very important Christmas things. You don't like topiary trees with snow on them, let me tell you, if you've read The Shining. So they get pretty scary. So
I don't even know what a topiary tree is.
Yeah, it's cut into like
sure
animal
it's very
shapes.
Important. Yeah, they is come, it like they, a placenta?
Yeah, no, but it's quite scary.
Sorry. My wife, by the way, told me not to talk to me. She was very worried about this show for some reason.
Actually, just to get that in, since we are talking about Christmas, Stephen King has said on numerous occasions that the fear not discourse that you get in Isaiah, where Isaiah 41, and then it comes into the Annunciation, all of that, the question of fear, he thinks is the most important question that all people need to deal with. And so his entire work, I mean, as an Episcopalian, he was raised as a Methodist, his wife was raised Catholic. I mean, a lot of their theological concern has been trying to figure out why fear is the only thing that will push Americans towards God. And so for him, he says that basically all the praise and all the glory that we try to muster up as evangelicals is not getting anybody close. He says what people get close to God is when they're scared to death.
This is Scott Derrickson says the same thing about the horror movie genre, is that it's the most important genre for Christian storytelling.
That's right.
And can I just tell you that Charles Dickens was there first in The Christmas Carol? I mean, the whole point of the redemption of Scrooge is the fear that comes from
the
dead. I mean, the ghost story is the original.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Christmas show has taken a strange, dark turn tonight. We're going towards the macabre tonight.
But an important one.
We're going to be hanging the baby Jesus momentarily.
That's right.
So, wow. So I wanted to start with any Christmas tradition that your family has carried on or that you remember from your childhood. And I'm going to share one to get us started.
Okay, good.
My grandfather was from Switzerland. And he couldn't play the piano, but every Christmas, to wake us all up, he would play the piano. And his piano playing did wake you up because he couldn't actually play the piano. I actually don't know what the hymn was that he played, but it was an old German hymn, and he would play this thing, and we would come downstairs. When he died, it was replaced by the playing of the bells. And in our house to this day, and through all of the generations of Staubs and through the grandchildren and everybody, you wake up to this sound that I'm about to play, and it's off of a German CD. A record, not available anymore. As a matter of fact, this is taped off of a record. And it's the song, O Thou Cheerful One, O Thou Holy One, in German. But the main thing is, it starts, whoa, that's not it.
No.
But that was kind of nice, too. Mm-hmm. But that wouldn't wake you up. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're laying in bed as a child. Visions of Sugar Plum dance in your head. You may know that. And all of a sudden, you hear this. Let's all sing this now.
Sounds German.
It is German. O thou cheerful one, O thou holy one. And that is a Christmas tradition in our family. Has anybody ever heard that CD before, that music? Yeah, and none of you wish to hear it again, do you? It's actually very sweet, and it's, you know, all the kids wait until they hear the bells to wake them up in the morning. I was in Zurich, Switzerland a few Decembers in my life. And, of course, they have a number of big churches. And one of the things about Switzerland is they've got bells everywhere. As a matter of fact, one of their big problems is it's a state-funded church, and they are essentially running out of money to fund all of these clocks and bells that they have in these churches that nobody attends. But I thought of this when I heard the bells there, and that's a simple little thing that we've done as a family. My dad started it when my grandfather died. And we have carried it on, and a few years ago we gave everybody a copy of a CD with it on so we can carry it on. Young Eli, my grandson, and we have an Eli over here. Where's Eli? Eli, one of Carlo's friends. My grandson, Eli, ran for student body president of his elementary school this year. He's in the fourth grade. Thank you, Carlo. So, Mr. Phoenix, pretty impressive, huh? Like I said, we're going to try to execute a flawlessly technical program tonight. But my grandson, Eli, ran for student body president in a sixth grade school. He ran for student body president in the fourth grade. He thought he'd win. And his speech, my son forwarded the speech and said, "Dad, I didn't talk to Eli about this. No one knows where he got this." His speech ended with, to the entire student body in elementary school, "In the words of Lao Tzu, every journey begins with one step. Let us begin our journey." It's a fourth grader. Wow. I think it's these bells that have gotten in his poor little wee little head.
Either that or his grandfather.
Oh, yeah. Well, it could be his grandfather. I said, "Josh, that actually has a certain reminiscent to it. You know, go to Google, get a quote, and go for it." Jeff, you told me that you had memories of an annual Swedish dinner of your two great aunts.
This is true. Yes, we did.
Are you Swedish?
A wide variety of things, but there was a strain of the Swedes in our family, and the two aunts. I don't know. When I watched The Simpsons, you remember the two aunts? You know? Okay. Well, they weren't really like them, but they were. They played a very interesting part in our childhood, and then every year they would host these enormous dinners that had the mysterious name of Krupp Krocker, which was basically a Swedish meatball in a Swedish potato ball.
Well, that's a relative of Betty Crocker, I believe.
Perhaps, yeah. Yes. And you would have them as an entree with gravy, and then you would have them the very same thing for dessert with jam on top.
How many Swedes are with us tonight? Isn't Voltman Swedish? Where's Dan? Dan is actually writing a Christmas carol right now. He's Danish? Are you Swedish? Oh, my Lord. Okay.
Well, this is valuable information, then. Yes. I've never heard of this.
You can say whatever you want. There's no Swedes here.
Years later, I was writing about this tradition and realized I had never had to spell it before, Krupp Krocker. The vowel sounds are different than the letters might imply. K-R-A-P, K-R-A-K-K-E-R. So,
wait, crap?
For most people, it looks like crap cracker. With the added enhancement that there's a KKK prominent. So I haven't really pursued writing about this tradition because it takes so much time to explain how to pronounce it anyway.
That is a precious tradition, Jeff. That was sure
a, that was a family.
Yeah, we're back Thank to you. Stephen King now, aren't we?
Yes.
You got us right back there. Do either of you guys have any Christmas traditions that you do in your family?
We do. My family, you know, is from the American Southwest, which is actually, most Americans don't know, is full of Irish people. You know, there was even actually a historian who traced that all those few cowboy feuds and the Hatfields and McCoys, those all are Irish clans. In fact, the KKK. They're that clannish, you know, I have a lot of blue-eyed, violent drinkers. And so my family has this interesting combination of sort of Texas and Ireland. So we always had chili rellenos and all that. So I was born in New Mexico. And then we would...
So is Rick Perry Irish?
No, I grew up in California. I was just born there.
We'd have
chili.
To go there.
Chili rellenos.
It would explain some things.
And, you know, Christmas style enchiladas, you know, the flat, like if you go to Santa Fe Cafe here, you'll get. And then we'd have Jamesons and Bushmills and drink to those who've gone before us all throughout the night.
It's very important and to drink to those who've gone before you.
We drink to those who've gone before us.
And there's probably a lot who went before you, right?
Oh, yeah. And we got to talk about all of them and tell the stories.
That's why the Irish are into family trees.
I tell you.
Because you've got thousands of people.
Right. We could always. So it was really interesting, you know, kind of quasi-Celtic, quasi-
Really?
Southwestern American.
And so this is true that the Irish settled in the South? I thought
absolutely.
They all settled in Boston and New York.
You know who's in the West is the Protestants. We're all the Northern Irish.
Oh.
Yeah. So you got the Irish Catholic, more traditional folk way. But, you know, rednecks come from King Billy, you know, the orange. They're the orange men from the North,
Right.
Radical Protestants. I mean, my grandfather Don't get him started on Catholics. Oh, but he's passed away now, so it's okay. I'll tell you. I'll edit what he
said. We would have a hard time getting him started on Catholics. but right now.
So even that, you know, so he's from Texas, and here I am growing up in the 70s in the San Francisco Bay Area. But he came over and said, "Chris, I noticed your next door neighbors are named. They just moved in, and they're Campbells. You don't trust a Campbell." And I was like,
"They make soup."
No.
Without potato.
Excuse me. No, the Campbells sold out the Scots to the English.
Oh, no. But,
Lord Campbell. Don't even get
me. Well,
how does
Joseph Campbell fit into that?
Oh, we don't trust him
Church
at all.
Of Christ.
We never trust a Campbell. Yeah.
The Campbellites.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was just odd for me. So we still, on Christmas Eve, we always have chili rellenos in honor of my grandmother and Christmas tree enchiladas, and we drink a lot of Jamesons and toast those.
What is a Christmas tree enchilada, just out of curiosity?
Red and green sauce.
Mm-hmm. How many of you have had chili relleno for Christmas?
I'm all right.
Oh, you've got A's. These are the Swedes after the Jamesons?
No.
They start having the chili relleno?
This was not my family, but if we go where we choose at Christmas, we go to the Santa Fe Cafe.
Absolutely.
There you go.
Yeah.
So, Jeff, what do you have as a family tradition? Anything?
Oh, yeah. We're kind of a mutt, you know, so we have a lot of different streams going through it. But I think the things that are happening in my family right now is the girls are getting older. And this tradition just came again just a couple nights ago when we were watching the Charlie Brown Christmas special, which is we have a series of films that you have to kind of earn the right to get to certain films, right? So we do certain things, then we get to watch Charlie Brown, certain things, right? And so... For me,
do certain things?
Well, I mean,
lesser ones.
There's lesser ones. You start with the back catalog, and then you're working towards the more sainted, you know, the canon within a canon, right? Is anybody else tracking with me on this point?
Yeah, totally.
All right. So Charlie Brown kind of is starting to get to the Gospels now when you start getting that close.
Right.
And so, but the thing is...
When do they get to Jesus?
That's
12th grade?
No, that's Frank Capra with me. That's when we finally get to It's a Wonderful Life, right? But in watching this together with my three daughters, one of the things that they do every year when we watch this is in the set piece when Schroeder is playing and everybody's dancing around and not paying attention to Charlie Brown, each individual person, Peppermint Patty, Sherman, all have their own distinctive dance.
Yes,
right?
They do.
And they all do their own thing, right? And so each year, each of the girls decides, okay, I get to be Sherman, I get to be Peppermint Patty, and they each have their own. So Sherman dances like Frankenstein. Yes. He only has his arms out like this the entire time. So my oldest daughter got to be Sherman this year, and that was kind of a big deal. So we got to each, so that's been a tradition so far.
Mm-hmm. Which are we doing Arizona? We okay? Yeah. We doing okay?
Yeah.
Okay,
so
good.
So that's one thing. We do Advent readings as we move forward throughout the Advent season as well, and a number of things on the night of that are too.
So now I asked each of you to name a Christmas song that you particularly like during Christmas. I thought that would be interesting. And Jeff, you started with a Lorena McKennitt song.
Right.
And tell us why this song made your cut.
Right, so we were asked to kind of think about, you know, some Christmas songs that are important to us. And Lorena McKennitt's kind of an interesting artist. She is, you know, kind of a Celtic revisionist artist. She kind of has ridden the new Celtic wave that really came into really high flower in the 80s. And she has a number of different releases that she's done, you know, taking kind of Elizabethan poetry, you know, Celtic poetry and things. But in this song, which is God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen, she did something really amazing. It's on a collection of Christmas and winter songs called a winter's season. And in this, she gathered a number of Middle Eastern artists together, Iranian artists and Palestinian artists together, to redo the song. And in a very similar way to Dave Brubeck, the jazz artist, when Dave Brubeck went to Turkey, he heard a different signature time to music that he wasn't hearing in American music. And so it moved from primarily the 4/4 time to the 5/8 time. And for Dave Brubeck, that changed everything. And similarly for Lorena McKennitt, by having these Eastern artists participate in this hymn, it subverted the song in a very unique way. So you have all this great instrumentation, a lot of jazz sensibilities, they're changing places. And because the time signature is different, you really hear the lyrics. So it takes this very traditional British him and moves it to Palestine, which is where Jesus was born.
Not a bad thing to remind it that the Christmas story is actually a Middle Eastern story.
Yeah, that's right.
It's not a Western story. And I love this piece too. I actually was in Egypt one December. Mm-hmm. I was in Egypt in Mahdi for a Christmas presentation at an international church there. Mm. And I was there for a wedding. And the music that she chooses here was very similar to the feeling of this music in Egypt. Mm-hmm. And when I heard her record this, I got that exact feeling. I got mm-hmm. this, oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. It's so much more Middle Eastern
yeah.
than British.
Yeah.
You know? So let's listen to a little of Lorena McKennitt, shall we? And just listen to the feel she gets. A Middle Eastern feel to Christmas. And I see Karen Stevens already got a dance in her head to this. She's like already grooving on this. Something's going to happen. Well, that and Charlie Brown in the...
God rest ye merry gentlemen, let nothing you dismay. Remember Christ our Savior was born on Christmas Day. To save us all from Satan's paws when we were gone astray. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy, comfort and joy. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy.
That's 4 minutes of a 6 minute, 50 seconds piece, but man, this is that is an amazing CD. I think it's only got five cuts on it.
There's an EP that
it's
has
called,
only five.
It's called A Winter Garden.
Winter's Garden, that's right.
And it is just more than worth picking up. Everything on it is just brilliant. Now you, this sophisticate from Berkeley, PhD.
Dork factor right here.
Well, actually, I have a quote from you.
Oh, no, from my email?
Put things in print.
This is what the lovely Chris Cheney said when I asked her to choose her song. I am incredibly dorky and not cool at all like Jeff Cuse and Jeff Overstreet.
Not
totally
true.
If
not
this
true.
Is your definition of cool, dear Chris.
Low bar.
But low bar, big low time. Bar. Big time. But you chose Amy Grant. And I found that.
Let's hear for Amy Grant, people.
Yeah.
You know you want to applaud.
Somebody buys her record.
No,
okay?
No. And I thought that was really bold. No, and yes. Sweet at the same time. So tell me about this song and how this was an important Christmas song for you.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, you know, as you guys know, I mean, I come from a non-Christian family. So, Amy Grant was like terra incognita to me, where, all the CCM stuff you guys all know backwards and forwards. And so coming from that same hard-drinking Irish family, not believers, and, a lot of brokenness from that and kind of being on my own journey as an adult, encountering that music, especially, I consider that Amy Grant's sad album. She was going through her divorce at that time. And, she's sort of the famous Christmas Christian music, but that one is really sad. Mm. And she chose, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. Over and over again, you feel her suffering and sorrow. And this particular song, and she's got the schmaltzy. I get it, mm-hmm. My kids can do the 80s synthesizer moves from, whatever other ones, CDs of hers. I only own her Christmas records. But this particular song, the first time I heard it, I actually stopped what I was doing and started crying. And I realized because it's a prayerful song, and I have been a teenage girl on my own without a family, and it's the line, and actually it was co-written with a British, Chris Eaton, a British man, so she's the co-author of it. And I'd be interested to know more about how that writing process went. But it's the lines, it's Mary's Magnificat. They're talking about, you chose me, here I am. But it's when it gets to the part where she says, help me be strong, help me be, help me. Mm-hmm. That I just went, okay, I get that. And that's
really sweet.
It's faith for me. So
you
that
know,
song was...
One Easter... Martin Marty, a famous church historian, his wife Harriet called me and said, have you ever heard the Vermeer Quartet, Seven Last Words of Christ? They're a famous quartet out of Chicago. And they had decided it was a Grammy-nominated album. And Haydn originally wrote that so that there were seven meditations on the Seven Last Words of Christ mm-hmm. between each of the musical movements. And she said, I'd really love it if you would consider having Richard, who's the leader of that group, on your show. And just talk about this. So we had him on a Good Friday. And Richard Young, and he was here with the Vermeer Quartet at University of Washington maybe 5 years ago, and he called me up and said, hey, let's have breakfast. I went to breakfast, and I had just been on a show at SPU the night before about contemporary Christian music, in which I did my usual trashing of contemporary Christian music.
Most of it's bad.
And Richard says, look, at least they're creating music. And he said, you understand that of everything Vivaldi wrote, only like 5% survived. We've only got the good stuff. He said, right. Vivaldi probably wrote a lot of really bad stuff. And he said, the thing that I love about the evangelical community, this is Richard Young, this famous violinist, is that they're making music. And it has energy, and they care about it, and there's work. Now, mm-hmm. I'm not dismissing all that happens. But I am saying that there are these moments of sincerity that we should not be... easily dismissive of. And I think you've just named an example of a song that broke through the clutter.
Yeah.
It's reminding me of Lauren Winter, who said she came to faith when she read Jan Karen's Mitford series and said, why couldn't it have been Dostoevsky?
Exactly.
Why couldn't it have been something like really serious intellectual?
Yeah.
But what actually got to me was the Mitford series.
It's sentimentality. It's what Dickens does.
Okay, let's listen to this Amy Grant song.
Such a Victorian.
I have traveled with a babe inside, and I wonder what I've done. Holy Father, you have come and chosen me now to carry your son. I am waiting in a silent prayer. I am frightened by the load I bear. In a world as cold as stone, must I walk?
Including that song, because I have to say I've seen so many breathless, young, hopeful teenage girls sing this song that I have really lost the sense of what the lyrics are about. And that help me is really powerful.
It is.
And you mentioned that given your background, you know, Isaiah, we're doing a series right now up on Orcas Island on Handel's Messiah as secrets to the Christmas universe. And we're taking different phrases from the Messiah. And this Sunday, it's the people walking in darkness have seen a great light.
Right.
On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned.
Right.
And you talked about kind of given your background
Absolutely.
Of darkness, light is a big theme for you at Christmas.
It's everything. And the reality of being alone, not everyone, thankfully, has that experience. But when you're really cast adrift in the darkness, too, Earl Palmer talks about being on the windy landscape. And when you've had that experience, when that's your life story, the speaking into, hold me together, pour your holiness is the, you know, the love and the fellowship that comes with faith is so palpable. So when you hear it articulated, it's like, it sound, you know, and they got the swelling, you know, schmaltz factor. But when that's your reality and someone articulates it, it's more meaningful than I think it would be with just a young girl singing
absolutely.
It in church or something. So it's the prayer. It's the prayer for those who need that.
Yeah. Thank you. That's really good. Jeff, you brought us Paul Simon.
Yeah, it's a good thing you brought up Amy Grant, because part of the reason this is personal to me, why Paul Simon's work is personal to me, started with Amy Grant when I was in 7th or 8th grade, growing up in Christian education, immersed in contemporary Christian music. Amy Grant was actually controversial, believe it or not.
Oh, really?
Because there were electric guitars, which was too much for some people. And she would occasionally sing a song to her husband, which was not then about Jesus, which was too close to secular music, and so that was controversial. I remember a debate in a class about some of her music, and I was getting excited about the idea that you could sing about anything, and if you sang about it well and truthfully, that was of God.
Right.
And she was kind of the person opening the door and saying, there's a bigger world.
Right.
And I went from Amy Grant to you to Peter Gabriel to Paul Simon.
Right.
And started really listening to Paul Simon and saying, well, eternity is written in our hearts. You can hear him singing about the Almighty all through Graceland.
Yeah.
I mean, especially in the title song.
Exactly.
And so I really started paying attention to him and am so grateful for him and so grateful that he's still going. So many of these artists from the 80s seem to feel this burden to try and regain what they once were or whatever. And Paul Simon just keeps going, just keeps doing what he does well. He hasn't put out a bad album. And he starts out this album, So Beautiful or So What is the name of it, which is sort of a way of taking us back to the tree of life, the way of nature or the way of grace, right? Which way are you going to go? And this whole album is about, he's talked about this, how he doesn't see that he's become a more religious person or that he wouldn't say he's become a Christian, but that he couldn't escape God and specifically Jesus. They kept showing up in the songs for this album.
Mm-hmm.
So he just...
No, this album is amazing. It's called So Beautiful or So What, mm-hmm. and there's two reference points. When John Stott died, I read this kind of obscure reference to the fact that Paul Simon spent an hour with John Stott. That he asked to come and meet with Paul Scott when he was with John Stott in England. And then the second reference point was a personal friend of mine, Kathy Falsani, who used to write for the Chicago Sun-Times and does a lot of interviews with people about their spiritual journey. She sent me a message about a month ago and says, you're not going to believe what just happened. Paul Simon just called me and wanted to talk about God. And she talked to him about God for 40 minutes, just out of the blue. She's a religion writer. And it's just fascinating to me that he's, and it's around the time and this album has just been released. I mean, I think he really is. He's not just asking questions so he can record songs that are going to sell.
He's a seeker.
He's actually describing what's going on in his life.
Well, and there's also a sense on this album that he gets the, you get the feeling that he knows he won't be producing a whole lot more albums in his lifetime.
Yeah.
And because every song here is sort of one of those Johnny Cash life or death songs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so he sets the stage with a Christmas song that starts by talking about the recession, about trying to make ends meet. The second verse is about, I've got a nephew in Iraq. It's his first time back. And he's worried about his nephew and hoping that he has the privilege of a Thanksgiving dinner on a mountaintop in Pakistan.
Yeah.
And the third verse brings us back to his own family here, and he wishes he could tell his mom and dad that the things they never had didn't matter. It was always okay.
Yeah.
So you've got money issues, you've got war, the global turmoil, you've got family tradition and the turmoil that some of us face during Christmas time, going back to see relatives. And the peaceful center of this hurricane is that we are all getting ready for Christmas Day in the specific sense, but also in the grand scheme of things. Our lives are a process of getting ready for Christmas Day when we see what really matters.
Yeah.
And I love this.
Well, if our faith can't stand up to reality, it's not a real faith. and he brings reality. Much like I heard The Bells of Christmas Day is actually an anti-war song, you know, of somebody writing out their reflections of Christmas during a time of war. And that's what Paul Simon does here. He just juxtaposes what people are experiencing with Christmas and takes the sentimentality out of it and gets to a heart of it. Here it is. So now in the background of this song, there's actually a little preaching going on.
And if you pick up the album, the entire sermon, the text of the entire sermon is in the liner notes, which is very, very nice.
And what's going on in the sermon?
And this is why I wanted a Wi-Fi signal before the show. So I could go because I had that set aside to tell you and couldn't get online. So email me. And
I actually just went on and tried to get on Wi-Fi to get the lyrics myself.
Yeah,
and I couldn't. But
you were talking about it a little bit.
Yeah, the story is that, you know, similar to Paul Simon's experience with Graceland, is that he got a collection of old Chess recordings, which, you know, Chess Records was one of the early R&B soul labels. And so in that, one of the collections he had was a collection of R&B as well as old sermons. And so this particular sermon was there, and he was just really taken with it. So he sampled the sermon in the background. So,
awesome.
Yeah.
One night I was driving in L.A. late at night. Well, early morning, 2 a.m. And I heard the Jim Morrison song, Stoned Immaculate, come on. Mm-hmm. And some DJ had laid it over a sermon. And this sermon was coming out of, in the background of it. And that juxtaposition was just, blew me away.
Yeah.
And that's kind of stuff that happens with Paul Simon. That's amazing. We're going to be back with more of the Kindling's Music Christmas right after this. Scott and Pam Nolte.
Woo-hoo!
Not that we haven't had a premier elite show already, but we're like bringing out some big guns
That's
next.
That's right.
So hang on, we'll be back with more coming up right after this. Don't go away. Seattle boy.
Garfield High School.
Did you go to Garfield?
I did. The Bulldogs.
Yeah. Jeff Cuse claims Quincy Jones, Garfield High School. And if you are up for a really contemporary view of the Messiah, pick up a soulful celebration. Yeah. And it's it really is amazingly arranged. And purists like my father just literally... Well, they just don't feel good about this. But I still play it. I actually seduce my dad because this is how this piece starts. And I said, Dad, I want you to listen to a new recording of The Messiah. It's like one of my favorites. It's just listen to this tenor, Dad. It's awesome. And Dad's 88 years old, wondering what his son is going to do next. He grasps his heart, his chest. The drum of it all. Yeah.
You know, when Handel wrote The Messiah, it was so controversial in Europe that it couldn't be performed there.
Because it was popular.
It was too popular, so it had to be premiered in Dublin. Because the Irish will take anything.
I have often, the Irish. Well, they've got all that Jameson flowing through their veins.
That's right.
But I've often asked myself if Handel came back, how he would feel about Quincy Jones. And I think it's a 90% chance that he would love it.
Yeah.
That he would
and
think it's like.
He'd love the royalties, by the way.
Well, he would like his royalties. I wrote this a few hundred years ago. I want my royalties.
Yeah, let's come back. Yeah, let's take that public domain out of there.
I just sent Marty O'Donnell a Christmas card, and it said, "What is Mozart doing today? He's decomposing." Which is.
That's a neat number.
Actually, you know, I did. I loaded in my rim shot from the old radio. Yeah, decomposing. Well, now, we have actual professional talent here tonight. we have decided to upgrade the show, ladies and gentlemen. No, I don't want my panel here to feel offended, because I dearly love each of you. And I appreciate you coming all the way from SPU, which, by the way, is like two blocks away. So inconvenienced in your schedule. I, of course, come from Orcas Island. But we have Scott and Pam Nolte, the founders, creative directors, and so much more of Taproot Theater. And I have to say, I am really proud of Taproot Theater. I mean, you really have no idea, if you haven't lived in other cities, what it is like to have this mid-sized theater successful for how many years now, Scott?
35. Wow.
35 years.
Amazing.
And best of all, respected for their work professionally.
Yes. Absolutely. Yep.
In a city like Seattle, which is a huge theater city, this is a big accomplishment.
Yes.
And we're so excited about it, we're not actually going to have them perform now. We're just, we want to be warmed in our hearts by their talent. No, actually, yeah, Scott, you told us you brought a low-budget production for us tonight, and I really want to say we appreciate that.
Well, you work with what you got, you know. This
yeah,
is
so
it.
What's the history of the Babushka piece?
We were founded in 1976, so we started with six founders during spring break of our senior year.
And by what school?
Seattle Pacific College.
Yo, there we go.
College.
Sorry, college. Sponsor.
That's right.
And we started with six, and by the time it got to fall, we were down to two.
That would be him and me.
The founding directors. We're the only people that could put up with each other.
And we haven't left. I'm not sure what's the smart decision there. But it was down to the two of us. We had an invitation to perform for actually a faculty party, a Christmas faculty
party. Where was that faculty
party? At Seattle Pacific University. How many times can we work it into
okay,
this?
Okay, so we're a cult. Let's just accept it.
That's right.
How many Seattle Pacific University graduates do we have
and
here tonight?
Students.
Oh, and students, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Okay.
So sort of on a wing in the prayer, we decided to put something together, and it really just came together in the living room of putting this thing in place. And lo and behold, we had a great time. We did it there for the faculty and had about four or five more requests to perform it between then and New Year's Eve. And it has come back virtually every year except for the last couple of years. So it's got like 32, 33 years of performances all over the Puget Sound region as well as even internationally. It's been done in Spain now. So it's a really simple sort of I don't want to get your...
It's story theater.
Yeah, it's story theater. So the listening audience is not missing any scenery.
Scott, we told them you're professional.
Well, we'll do our best. It's just that there's no... If you're expecting scenery, there's nothing here because it's really in your heads.
Carlo, and, scenery, please.
Yeah. So we did it on the Opera House stage and we did it in living rooms because it really is as simple as just two actors. And
with
it is
hand puppets and shadow lights. No, we didn't even bring
hand puppets. Okay, I mean Kermit or
yeah, that's it.
But it really was just you know, two actors, two stools, a muffler and a shawl in its simplest form. And okay. Tonight we elected just to bring sort of the middle story, just a short story out of the middle of the whole trilogy.
Cuz we think we did Martin the Shoemaker for you a few years ago.
You did.
Ago.
Yeah. It was awesome.
Yeah.
So yeah, we'll never forget it.
We're working our way backwards to the play.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go with Babushka.
Here we go.
Well, when all things began, the word already was. And the word dwelt with God. And the word was God. The word then was with God in the very beginning, and through him all things came to be. No single thing was created without him. Through him, all things that came to be were alive with his life. And that life was the light of men. And the light shines out in the darkness, and the darkness has never quenched it. And the Word became flesh, and he came to dwell among us. And we saw his glory. Such glory as befits the Father's only Son, full of grace and truth. Now, as if to greet the Son of God, the very heavens proclaimed his coming. And in the Far East, three magi scientists, astrologers of their day, saw this sign in the heavens and set off to search for the newborn King of the Jews. 2 years before his actual birth. Now, an old Russian legend has it that they traveled to that distant country, and there they sought help and directions from an old Russian peasant woman named Babushka.
Long ago and far away, on a winter's eve, the wind blew hard and cold around a small hut. Inside, Babushka was sweeping and scrubbing and cleaning her home and feeding wood to her fire. The old woman took pride in the clean comfort of her meager home. And as the snow swirled and deepened outside, Babushka's hut felt snug around her. Her warm fire was the center of a cold world. As day turned into night, a trumpet call sounded on the wind. A train of travelers was approaching. Leading them was a sleigh drawn by beautiful white horses, and in it three men, magnificent figures with jeweled crowns and cloaks of crimson and fur. Behind them rode men on horseback, and following them, men on foot. The procession drew up and stopped in front of Babushka's hut. And when she heard a knock and went to the door, she found one of the men standing there.
Oh, I bid you welcome. Good sir, my name is Babushka, humble peasant woman.
We are following a star to a place where a child is born, but we have lost our way in the storm. Come with us, Babushka. Help us to find the child, to offer him gifts, and to rejoice in his birth.
Good sir, bid your friends to enter in and warm themselves by my fire, where I have not yet finished my day's chores, and I shudder to go out on a night such as this. Morning is wiser than evening. Rest yourselves here for the night, and I shall go with you in the dawn.
There is no time to linger, Babushka. If you do not come with us now, we must continue our journey alone. And with that, the travelers turned their train in a new direction and were gone into the night. Babushka went back to her sweeping and to her scrubbing, and later on sat down to a lonely supper by the stove. The warmth of the fire seemed to reach into her heart. She felt a sudden tenderness and joy for the newborn babe.
What grand gentlemen they were. Indeed, they did seem like kings. 'Tis no ordinary babe they seek. I must follow them.
To find the child, to offer him her gift, was now her one yearning. The desire burnt in her heart like a candle in the dark. The next morning, Babushka placed into her sack a few poor but precious gifts. And as the new day began, she stepped out onto the snow to hunt for the path left by the travelers, but discovered that the snow had covered their way. Stopping one person and then another, and still another, she asked,
"In which direction did the three kings go? They who sought the child?"
But no one could tell her. From village to village, from door to door, she went asking,
"Have you seen the child?"
But always she received the same answer. No one had seen him. Always seeking, never stopping, Babushka went on searching for the child, but never finding him. And it is said that every year at the season when the birth of a child was first heralded, Babushka renews her search across that land with new hope. And it is said that every year the children await the coming of Babushka, for they find joy in the few poor but precious gifts she leaves behind her in the silent night.
Thank you so much, Scott and Pam Nolte. That was wonderful. Jeff, you have an Annie Dillard piece for us.
Yeah, one of the things I love about Christmas time is snow. And one of the things I love about being in the Pacific Northwest is that snow is accessible, even if it's not where we are right here in the Seattle region. And stories about snow and snowball fights and things like that always seem to kind of bring that back to me. And one of the stories that I love, a set piece, it's in one of Annie Dillard's memoirs, which is entitled An American Childhood. She talks about growing up in Pittsburgh and growing up in a Presbyterian church and just trying to make sense of, you know, these growing up years. And there's a nice little story she talks about a snowball fight. And it's all, and I come back to this story, I think, every year as a reminder of the way that God pursues us. And so I thought I'd just read a section of this story. And it's a wonderful story about children. One weekday morning after Christmas, 6 inches of new fallen snow had come. We were standing up to our boot tops in snow on a front yard on trafficked Reynolds Street waiting for cars. The cars traveled on Reynolds Street slowly and evenly. They were targets all but wrapped in red ribbons, cream puffs. We couldn't miss. I was 7. The boys were 8, 9, and 10. The oldest two Fehe boys were there, Mickey and Peter. Polite blonde boys who lived near me on Lloyd Street who already had 4 brothers and sisters. My parents approved of Mickey and Peter Fehe. Chickie McBride was there, a tough kid, and Billy Paul and Mackie Keen, too, from across Reynolds, where the boys grew up, dark and furious, grew up skinny, knowing, and skilled. We all drift from our homes that morning looking for action, and we found it here on Reynolds Street. It was cloudy but cold. The car's tires laid behind them on the snowy street, a complex trail of beige chunks, like castle walls. I stepped on some earlier. They squeaked. I could have wished for more traffic. When a car came, we all popped up at it at once. In the intervals between the cars, we reverted to our natural solitude as children. I was making the perfect ice ball, a perfect ice ball, from perfect white snow, perfectly spherical and squeezed perfectly translucent, so no snow remained all the way through. I had just embarked on the ice ball project when we heard the tire chains come clanking from afar. A black Buick was moving toward us down the street. We all spread out, banged together with some regular snowballs, took aim, and when the Buick came nigh, fired. A soft snowball hit the driver's window shield right before the driver's face. It made a smashed star with a hump in the middle. Often, of course, we hit our target, but this time, the only time in all of life, the car pulled over and stopped. The black door flew open wide. A man got out running, and he didn't even close the car door. He ran after us. We ran away from him up the snowy sidewalk. At the corner, I looked back. Incredibly, he was still after us. He was in city clothes, a suit and tie, street shoes. Any normal adult would have quit, having sprung into flight and made his point. This man was gaining on us. He was thin, all action, and all of a sudden, we're running for our lives. Wordless, we split up. We're on our turf. We could lose ourselves in the neighborhood backyards, everyone for himself. I paused and considered. Everyone had vanished except Mickey Fehe, who was just rounding the corner of a yellow brick house. Poor Mickey. I trailed him. The driver of the Buick sensibly picked the two of us to follow. The man apparently had all day. He chased Mickey and me around the yellow house, up a back path we knew by heart, under a low tree, up a bank, around a hedge, down some snowy steps, across the grocer's driveway. We smashed through a gap between the hedges, entered a scruffy backyard, ran around the back porch, and tight between the houses on Edgerton Avenue. We crossed Edgerton into an alley, up to our own sliding wood pile, and there we stood. He kept coming. He ran up Lloyd Street, wound through the mazy backyards towards a hilltop in Willard and Lang. He chased us silently, block after block. He chased us silently over picket fences, through stony hedges, between the houses, around garbage cans, across the streets, and every time I glanced back, choking for breath, I expected that he would have quit. He must have been breathless as we are, his jacket strained over his body. He was an immense discovery, pounding into my hot head every sliding joyous step, that this ordinary adult evidently knew what I thought only children knew. That if you fling yourself at what you're doing and point yourself and forget yourself and aim and dive, anything is possible. He chased us across the backyards. We three, he grabbed us by our coats, and we stood there staggering, half-blinded, coughing in an obscure hilltop backyard. A man in his 20s, a boy and a girl. He released our jackets, our pursuer, our captor, our hero. He knew we weren't going anywhere. We all played by the rules. Mikey and I unzipped our jackets. We pulled off our sopped and mittens. Our tracks multiplied in the backyard's new snow. We had broken new snow all morning. It was a long time before we could speak, and I had some difficulty at first recalling why we're even there at last. My lips felt swollen. I couldn't see out of the sides of my eyes, and I kept coughing. "You stupid kids," he began perfunctorily. We listened perfunctorily indeed, if we listened at all, for the chewing out was redundant, a mere formality, and beside the point. The point was that he had chased us passionately without giving up. And so he had caught us, and now he came down to earth, and I wanted that glory to last forever.
Wow. That is great.
And what I love about that story is, for me, that's what Advent is all about, is that for 400 years of silence, people wondered if God was even there. And with the inbreaking of the Annunciation, we realized that we weren't the only ones chasing after God, that sometimes the black door flies open, and the least that we could expect comes chasing after us with everything, holding nothing back, something that only children knew, that if you commit yourself entirely to something, magic happens.
Wow.
And she just really gets that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is awesome. That's in a writer's life.
Yeah, it's in American Childhood by Annie Dillard.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. You had for us, Chris,
yes,
a pink martini song.
Well, of course. Because apparently I'm on the pink thing going on here today.
Which is a good
tell me yeah. about this song.
This is amazing. I'm sure a lot of you know about Pink Martini, a Portland-based band. They're very interested in sort of world eclectic music. And this powerful prayer, I realized, you know, preparing the show, Dick, that I was really drawn to prayers this time. Mm-hmm. And it's the kind of calling out of that one-on-one with God. And so this is from the Amida, which is, I'm not the theologian here, but I've learned mm-hmm. a bit. This is the meditation at the end of this prayer cycle that's recited every day. It's mm-hmm. it's an everyday prayer, and in the Christian tradition, we use parts of it, and it'll be sung in Hebrew by Ari Shapiro, who's the NPR White House correspondent. Did anybody go to the Pink Martini show a couple weeks ago? They were in town, and all I can say is Ari Shapiro, he's mega handsome. You think, you know, radio, he's got, you know, a face for radio or something?
You've moved out of a prayer life.
Oh, now, oh my. So I'm just telling you, okay?
And we're back.
And a woman cantor from Portland, and then China Forbes, who's the lead singer. And then in English, the prayer is from the Torah, "My God, guard my speech from evil and my lips from deception before those who slander me. I will hold my tongue. I will practice humility. Open my heart to your Torah, that I might pursue your mitzvot, your blessings. As for all who think evil of me, cancel their designs and frustrate their schemes. Act for your own sake, for the sake of your power, for the sake of your holiness, for the sake of your Torah, so that your loved ones may be rescued. Save with your power and answer me. May the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable to you, Adonai, my rock and redeemer."
This is from Pink Martini, "Joy to the World." Amazing. Here it is.
Elohai netzor lo shonim meira usvatai midaber mima v'lim kalelai nafshi titom v'nafshi ke'afal akol tiye Elohai netzol shomim era usvatai midaber mima v'lim kalelai nafshi titom v'nafshi ke'afal akol tiye Elohai netzol shomim era usvatai midaber mima V'lim kalelai nafshi titom v'nafshi ke'afal akol tiye Elohai, Elohai, p'tach libi.
Thank you.
My God, guard my speech from evil and my lips from deception. Before those who slander me, I will hold my tongue. I will practice humility. Open my heart to your Torah. May the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable to you, Adonai, my rock and redeemer. If you would have told me back in the 60s that Pink Martini was going to sing a Jewish prayer on a Christmas album called Joy to the World, I would have absolutely thought you were nuts. And yet, God is...
And I love the fact that thousands of people in Starbucks are buying this CD.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, you know, it's...
You never know where grace is going to show
when,
up.
Yeah. God will proclaim his glory through whoever is receptive to being the proclaimer. And it could be Martin Scorsese. It could be anybody that hears a voice, a word, and shares it honestly and authentically. And in this case, it's Pink Martini singing in Hebrew. That's amazing. Jeff, you've got a little D.H. Lawrence for us.
Yeah, and just a quick meandering introduction here. We were talking about traditions earlier, and at my house, when I was growing up, my family, we made things at Christmas time. We didn't really have a lot of money to go do things or buy things, but we made stuff all the time. We made Christmas cards and cookies and handmade gifts, and I would make puppet shows based on whatever Rankin Bass animated Christmas special was on TV that year. And my grandfather built me a puppet stage, which is now my writing desk, and I'm still making stuff there and thinking of him. It was a time to focus on our favorite things and then respond to them by making something new from it that would continue to expand it. And there came a point when I was about ready to start college that I think my dad saw that I was still just immersed in fantasy stories. That seemed to be where my interests were going. But he saw that I was interested in lists of favorites, which is probably why I became a film critic, because that's what you do at Christmas time, right? So he knew that I was interested in lists of favorites, but he also knew I was interested in the harder stuff, the theology that he was reading. So he gave me a book called Reality and the Vision by a group called the Chrysostom Society, which includes writers like Lucy Shaw, Philip Yancey, Emily Griffin, Calvin Miller, Stephen Lawhead, Eugene Peterson, Seattle Pacific College, ladies and gentlemen, Walter Wangren. And in this book, they talk about their favorite writers, the writers who most moved them. So it was a list of favorites. It was the stuff Dad read. So I was really into this, and they introduced me to so many great writers and poets. I discovered Flannery O'Connor because Harold Fickett wrote an essay about Flannery O'Connor in here. So,
how old were you when you were given this book?
Let's see, I was a senior in high school, so probably about 18.
Good for your dad.
So I recommend this to you as a Christmas gift because basically what you're giving them here is like a little free ticket to a whole bunch of the greatest writers writing about the greatest writers. It's since been republished as a book called More Than Words. And if the people in your family who might be interested in this are also interested in writing, they've done a book about writing as well called A Syllable of Water, where they sort of tell the secrets of their own writing. And then lately, more recently, Image put together a book with a lot of the same writers called God With Us, which is an Advent reader. With reflections by Lucy Shaw, Scott Cairns, Emily Griffin, Kathleen Norris, Eugene Peterson, and more. So I highly recommend all of those. But all of that to say that I wanted to make stuff in response to what I was reading there. And I'm just so glad, so thankful that they use Christmas as an opportunity to encourage incarnation. And I think that's what makes Christmas so specifically wonderful in the calendar, is its emphasis on incarnation. And so I want to share this poem by D.H. Lawrence, one of those writers I might never have discovered if the wider world of literature hadn't been introduced to me by my dad. This poem is called Demiurge. They say that reality exists only in the spirit, that corporeal existence is a kind of death, that pure being is bodiless, that the idea of the form precedes the form substantial. But what nonsense it is. As if any mind could have imagined a lobster dozing in the underdeeps, then reaching out a savage and iron claw. Even the mind of God can only imagine those things that have become themselves. Bodies and presences here and now, creatures with a foothold in creation, even if it is only a lobster on tiptoe. Religion knows better than philosophy. Religion knows that Jesus was never Jesus till he was born from a womb and ate soup and bread and grew up and became, in the wonder of creation, Jesus with a body and with needs and a lovely spirit.
Wow.
That's included in a book called The Gospels in Our Image, which gives you the outline of the gospel story and has poets from all different eras, all different cultures, all different beliefs responding to the events in the gospels with their own poetry. You'll read some things that are probably very unsettling to you, but also some that are very beautiful and inspiring. And so I recommend The Gospels in Our Image, an anthology of 20th century poetry based on biblical texts. And that's where I discovered that particular Christmas
poem. This
has
been amazing tonight. Like, I've gotten a whole shopping list here tonight. For myself, of course. I haven't done my Christmas shopping for others, but I've got a lot of interesting ideas for myself. Dan, as you get ready to sing for us, I want you, Jeff, to tell us about this wonderful children's book that you want to recommend to us this Christmas.
Well, there was always a festival of children's books in our house. My mom was a kindergarten teacher. So, of course, we've got the Berkeley Breathed Red Ranger Came Calling, the guy who did Bloom County. And I interviewed
him on that book, and he was a holdout in that he would refuse to go computer graphics design. He did every panel in this book as a painting and held out against the computer technology, and it has never been heard of since. But it's a wonderful piece of work.
Yeah, and he did a wish for wings that work, you know, about the poor flightless opus, knowing he was somehow made to fly, which gets to me on but we can talk about that afterwards. But the one I brought to really show you is by Kate DiCamillo, who wrote The Tale of Despero, and Because of Winn-Dixie. This is a great Christmas book called Great Joy, about a young girl who notices a homeless organ grinder with his monkey on the street corner and wants to invite him in, and mother says no. And mother says no every time she tries to help this man. So she invites him to the place where she knows he'll be welcomed, church. And she's in the Christmas pageant as an angel. And she's up front watching and waiting. And I'm not going to include spoilers. There's a reason it's called Great Joy. And it's beautifully illustrated. So if you want to come up afterwards and take a look, and all of you listening on the podcast, I'll hold this up very high so you can see how beautiful this book is. Great Joy by the great Kate DiCamillo.
Without doing a spoiler, though, Jeff, tell us the theme of How the Resurrection Really Feels by the Hold Steady. Tell us what happens in that story, because there's a connection to this story.
Oh yeah, like one of my favorite bands is called the Hold Steady, and the song that Dick is referencing is a song that's in my book, Your Neighbor's Hymnal, and it's a narrative about
a lovely Christmas gift.
But it's a narrative where you have this woman who's a drug addict, who's led a very sordid life, comes stumbling into the middle of a Catholic mass, knocking over everything in the process, and asks if she can basically have an ear of everybody. And she goes, let me tell you what a resurrection really is about. And she begins to then tell the entire congregation about how sordid her life was and what it means to be found. And it's a wonderful experience of having, you know, an upside-down kingdom all of a sudden happen. And the prophet, you know, is the person you least expect who comes stumbling into a service. So it's a wonderful story.
Well, Jeff showed me this story, The Great Joy, before the show tonight, and I read through it, and I thought of that song. And it's so amazing that at Christmas we all dress up and go to our nice little church services, and Jesus came to make sure that the people that would not normally show up would feel welcome there. And these are both great reminders of that. What we're going to do now, in the interest of time, is we're going to have Dan Voetman, another Kindling's Hearth alum, is going to sing a wonderful song for us. And then we're going to sing a couple of Christmas carols and call it a night. But this has been a really rich experience together, and I hope that our time together has given us a chance to laugh and to reflect and to think a bit about the Christmas season and the messages of Christmas. Dan, tell us about this song, and I joked that Dan was writing a Christmas carol. He was actually writing out the lyrics for this Christmas carol because he left them at the office. But what attracted you to this song, Dan?
Well, it was so often songs I like to sing, I'll just hear it, and maybe it's the context or whatever, but suddenly that song just jumps out at me. I was at a wedding this summer, and the bride and groom sang to each other the Beatles tune, I Will. And I thought, wow, that's cool. So anyway, I was in church last year, and I heard this song, and I just thought, that's a beautiful song. And then I just kind of filed it away. I need to learn that sometime. And then I got Dick's note this week, hey, would you like to listen? He said, oh, okay, that's a good excuse to work on it. But it's just, it comes from a poem that was written for a poetry contest back in 1872. And the lady who wrote the poem and then never published it other than in the magazine. And then after she died, her poems were collected. And then the composer who wrote The Planets, Gustav Holst, read the poem somehow, and he put it to music. And
amazing.
It's beautiful.
So. I never heard that story. Thanks,
so,
Dan.
Anyway.
In the bleak midwinter.
Yeah, it goes like this.
In the bleak midwinter, icy wind made moan. Earth as hard as iron, water like a stone. Snow on snow had fallen, snow on snow on snow. In the bleak midwinter, long and long ago, angels and archangels may have gathered there, cherubim and seraphim rising in the air. Oh, but only Mary in her maiden bliss worshipped the Beloved with the mother's kiss. Heaven and earth will fall away when he comes to reign. What then can I give him? Empty as I am. If I were a shepherd, I would bring a lamb. If I were a wise man, I would know my part. What else can I give him? I must give my heart. If I were a wise man, I would know my part. What else can I give to him? I will give my heart.
Well, Dan and Marguerite have been great friends of the Kindlings over the years, and very faithful in participating in all sorts of ways in what we're doing to try to rekindle the intellectual and spiritual and creative legacy that we have a responsibility to carry out in our culture. And I thank you a lot, Dan. Dan's going to lead us now in a couple of Christmas carols. We're just going to sing Silent Night and Away in a Manger. We didn't bring the lyrics. We figured most of you would know them. We are, however, in honor of Chris, going to sing them in Hebrew tonight, which may be a challenge for some of you.
Kadosh, but, kadosh, kadosh.
So, Dan, go ahead and lead us in the Silent Night and then in Away in a Manger, sure. And that'll be the conclusion of our show tonight.
Okay.
Don't be bashful. Sing up for us.
Silent Night. Holy night, all is calm, all is bright, round yon virgin mother and child. Holy infant, so tender and mild, sleep. Talking about, let's see, in the laid down his sweet head. The stars in the sky looked down where he lay. The little Lord Jesus asleep on the hay. The cattle are lowing, the bear baby wakes, but little Lord Jesus no crying he makes. I love thee, Lord Jesus, look down from on high and stay in thy tender care, and fit us for heaven to live with thee there.
Thank you very much. Wow, what a great evening. I'm going to ask each of our guests to ask them if they have a final word they'd like to share with us, and we'll start with Jeff Overstreet.
I will read a very short poem.
Okay.
To remind us, one of my favorite bands is Over the Rhine. If you know, if you visit any of my websites, you know I'm kind of obsessed with them. But they write Christmas music that's a little different. And one time after their second Christmas album came out, they were at a party with some friends, and the friends said, "Do you like Christmas?" Their music is at Christmas time focuses on a lot of the brokenness that we also see, and I think it's important to include that in the picture, to expand the Thomas Kincaid frame, to include more of the Christmas scene, and why we need the darkness that the light is shining within. So this is a poem by a Russian poet whose name I will not attempt to pronounce. About a chapter of the Christmas story that it's easy to forget. The children cried, "Mummy, but I have been good. It's dark in here, dark. See them, they are going to the bottom. See the small feet. They went to the bottom, do you see? That print of a small foot here and there. Pockets bulging with string and stones. And little horses made of wire. A great plain closed like a figure of geometry, and a tree of black smoke, a vertical dead tree with no star in its crown." This poem is dedicated to the museum in Auschwitz, 1948. A chapter of the story that it's important to remember when I don't know. I hear myself complaining. It's so hard to take hold of the spirit of Christmas when you're watching the news right now or when you've had the day you've just had, and then you remember it was a day as dark or darker than that that the Christ child was born.
Good word.
Yes. So I have the chorus from a Christmas oratorio written by the poet W.H. Auden, of all things, never set to music.
Wow.
Here's what the chorus is. He is the way. Follow him through the land of unlikeness. You will see rare beasts and have unique adventures. He is the truth. Seek him in the kingdom of anxiety. You will come to a great city that has expected your return for years. He is the life. Love him in the world of the flesh, and at your marriage, all its occasions shall dance for joy.
Well, I'd like to give my last thought to the future, which is the creation of art. And I would like to challenge everybody here and those listening to the podcast to give even a little bit to an arts organization this Christmas at the end of the year. And I'm going to name check Karen Stevens Dance Company, International Arts Movement, Taproot Theater Company, Image Journal, and the Kindlings. That if you have in your heart...
Donor envelopes are available on your tables.
But even a little bit. Your lives have been made rich because people proclaimed light in the darkness. And in this season of all seasons, we need your help to keep the arts alive.
Good word. That's it? Like a donor pledge? A donor pitch?
Hey. Okay.
Is your final word for Christmas?
Okay, I'll give my short one from Hamlet.
Okay, that would be good.
All right. Hamlet, Act 1, Scene 1. Because Shakespeare really should have the last word, for me at least. Some say that ever against that season comes wherein our Savior's birth is celebrated. The bird of dawning singeth all night long, and then, they say, no spirit dares stir abroad. The nights are wholesome, and then no planet strike, no fairy takes, nor witch hath power to charm, so hallowed and so gracious is the time.
Wow. I'm going to close with Auden also, and it's a couple of excerpts from his September 1st, 1939, which he wrote the night that Hitler invaded Poland, and everybody suddenly in the world realized that Hitler had been lying to the world about his aspirations. And I thought of this poem along with Yeats's The Second Coming when I was reflecting on Handel's Messiah's The Secrets of the Christmas Universe and the oratorio sung by a bass, but who may abide the day of his coming, and who shall stand when he appeareth? For he is like a refiner's fire, and he shall purify the sons of Levi. It's kind of like the Santa Claus song. There's good news, but there's also a naughty list. And Auden says this, I sit in one of the dives on 52nd Street, uncertain and afraid, as the clever hopes expire of a low, dishonest decade. Does that sound familiar? A dishonest decade? Waves of anger and fear circulate over the bright and darkened lands of the earth, obsessing our private lives. The unmentionable odor of death offends the September night. Faces along the bar cling to their average day. The lights must never go out. The music must always play. All the conventions conspire to make this fort assume the furniture of home, lest we should see where we are, lost in a haunted wood, children afraid of the night, who have never been happy or good. Defenseless under the night, our world in stupor lies, yet dotted everywhere, ironic points of light flash out wherever the just exchange their messages. May I compose like them of Eros and of dust, beleaguered by the same negation and despair, show an affirming flame. Wow. In the darkness, that we might at least be an affirming flame. It's been a great evening. A lot to think about. Thoughtful people. Great reminders. Babushka. Wonderful song by Dan. Well sung by Dan. And Jeff Overstreet, Jeff Cuse, Chris Chaney. This is Dick Staub. You've been listening to the Kindlings Muse Christmas 2011. We'll look forward to seeing you next time.